That man is Robert Mazzard. Robert Mazzard was a Frenchman who had fallen out with de Candolle and had left the railway and was living in France. So father said, I think I can trace him, and if I can, I'll let you know, and then you'll have to just get in touch with him and make your conditions, etc., and see what he says. Well, to cut a long story short, Mazzard took on the job. Father went back with Mazzard and reported to the board that everything had now been handed over and Mazzard was in charge. The board then did something that they'd never done before. The company had no pension scheme or anything of that sort. There was very little money in the kitty. And the board called Father before them all to extend their thanks for the wonderful service that he had rendered the company over so many years. And he was told, we have no money that we can really compensate you sufficiently. But purely as a token of our esteem and appreciation of what you have done, we give you this check and only wish there could have been 10 times more. And they gave Father a check for £5,000. Under the circumstances, my father thought that this was most generous, and he was most touched by that action. Now this brings us to the end of 1921-22. As far as father was concerned, so I'll go back to Francis and myself. After the fire, Francis went to Cyprus for a few weeks, then decided to go to Canada to take up fruit farming. He came to London. Father persuaded him to stay in this country and to try farming over here. Father's argument was, we've lost 2 sons. We only have you and Charles here. Charles is settled in London. If you go to Canada, it'll be a number of years before you can really settle down there and do much. We are getting too old to travel, and it's quite likely that we shall never see you again. So will you consider trying farming in this country, and I will stand more as guarantor, stand behind you, and help you all I possibly can. Francis did this. He bought a small farm at Highhurst Wood in Sussex, about 2 or 3 miles from Uckfield and Buxted. He never made much of a success of it, and really ended his days there, with at least his working days there, with father having to subsidize him all the way. From 1922 to 1940, when father died, father helped Francis all along the way, not with huge sums, but it was just a question of 10, 20, 30 pounds every month to pay bills and so on. Besides which, of course, mother did all sorts of things to help Katie with the house. I mean, for instance, mother always made enough marmalade for the whole family. By that time, they'd had another child, and there were four of them in the family. And father paid for their education, and the mother made things like marmalade, made 50, 60, 70 pounds of marmalade for them at a time, besides doing all their mending and a lot of repairing and buying the children a lot of clothes and so on. So Francis Ray did not make a success, not even a partial success, of the farm down at Highhurst Wood. And in 1946, 47, poor old Katie died, and Francis lived on his own for a year or so, and then went to live with his married son, younger son, Arthur. Got gangrene in a toe, which spread up his leg. He had to have a leg amputated. His wish to live had gone with the passing of his dear wife, Katie, a wonderful person. John had gone into the army in the Second World War, in the Veterinary Corps. He then joined the Gunners as an officer, went to West Africa, and then on to the India-Burma frontier, came back and took up his studies once again as a vet, got married to a girl he met in the army, one of his ATS girls, Vera, charming, lovable little person. And he went on studying and eventually passed his exams and set up as a vet, as a partner to a veterinary surgeon at Raleigh, near Southend, as a paid assistant to Mr. Mackenzie. He had two children, both sons, who today, 1974, are aged about 23 and 21. And John himself carried on with Mr. Mackenzie as a paid assistant till Mr. Mackenzie took him into partnership. In due course, Mr. Mackenzie committed suicide, and John took over the whole of the practice and employed his own assistants, and is now doing, I believe, very well. The other son, Francis' son, Arthur, he also married. He was at Cambridge when he came out of the RAF, where he'd been a Met officer. And he and his wife, both very clever, she's a lecturer at one of the hospitals, and Arthur is also a lecturer. The last time I heard, he was a lecturer at the Veterinary College, strangely enough. But they're both very clever people and do a lot of traveling all over the world, giving lectures and holding discussions, etc., and conferences with people in the Soviet Union, Czechoslovakia, Germany, France, United States of America, and so on. But whilst we have kept very close in touch with John, Arthur and his wife Pam seem to have drifted out of our circle, and although we do hear of them through John now and again, we have very little communication with them direct. Now I come to myself, and of course, being my own story, it's probably going to be rather lengthy and possibly too much of the I in it. But this, after all, is my record of our family, and obviously I know more about myself than I know about others, and I have more anecdotes and things to relate about my doings than I can possibly have about other people's affairs. So I must be forgiven if what follows is rather too much of the I. After the First World War was over, I went back to Smyrna, joined Francis tobacco farming at Kushadasi, no, I beg your pardon, at Develikyi, only for a short time, saw that there was nothing in it, and I sold out to an army colleague called Bliss, and I went to the Melachrino Tobacco Company as sort of office manager, just a small office in Smyrna, where we bought tobacco from all the merchants, all the growers around the district. We employed 400 or 500 natives to manipulate the tobacco, to sort it out and put it into different categories, and then we shipped it to America, direct to the parent company. My boss was a Mr. Snow, quite an interesting man, and Middle East headquarters were in Kavala, in Greece. I went to Kavala for 2-3 months, and long before that, before going back to Smyrna, I had got engaged to a girl called Jess Attridge in Sutton. And it had been arranged that I would go back to Smyrna, fix up things for an autumn marriage. I went back to Smyrna in February, fix up things for an autumn marriage, and I would come back to England to collect her about September, October. When I was in Kavala, I had a letter from her breaking off the engagement. That was that. Soon after leaving Kavala, I went back to Smyrna. I decided that there was no future for me in Smyrna. I intended one day to get married. I wasn't greatly thrilled with the idea of having a family out in Smyrna with a local English girl, perhaps, making the second or third generation. I'd seen enough of so-called Levantines, English people who had lived out there and married and remarried and intermarried generation after generation, till, although they still looked English, they spoke English, they really thought more in Greek or Turkish. And I decided that I was coming back to England. There was great opposition on the part of my parents, who couldn't see why I couldn't stay in Smyrna. But I overcame the opposition, came over to England, and it is really extraordinary how things work out. I was in London. I'd gone in with a chap who had advertised for an assistant. Put quite a few £100 in his business. Found out the chap was a swindler, and he'd been swindling a lot of young ex-officers. We took the matter up to Scotland Yard, handed it over to them. They prosecuted the chap, cost us nothing, and the chap got 2 years in the second division. In the meantime, I'd met in London an old school chum. Actually, my greatest chum in Smyrna was Ernest Xenopoulos, the son of an English mother and a Greek Roman Catholic father. She, the mother, had been a Miss Wade. Later on, they went to settle in Paris and they changed their name back to Wade. So Ernest was my great pal. His elder brother, Willie, was in London. And we met up, had a few meals together. And one day he said to me, look, I've got to go back to Paris. And I have a date here to go to a dance on Saturday with a Miss Potter, who is a friend of a chap who came out to Smyrna from England, and he gave us the introduction to this girl, Miss Potter. She's a nice person, and I'd like you to take my ticket and go to this dance. Now I'll write to her and tell her that I can't come, but I had passed my ticket on to an old chum of mine from Smyrna. So I went to this dance and met this Miss Potter. And we met again and again. And in due course, Miss Potter, her proper full name is Edith Florence Potter, but she'd lost two brothers in the war, and they always called her Sis, with the result that she was always known as Sis Potter, and Sis became my wife. We were married in 1923. I had lost quite a bit of money with that chap, that swindler. I got an introduction to the manager of a labor exchange at Ludgate Hill, who told me to go and see the Swiss bank, as they wanted people from Switzerland, and he refused to give them permits to bring people in from Switzerland, as he said he could find them people in London. So I went to the Swiss bank, had my interview, saw the general manager, who on hearing that I knew Greek, just said one word to me in Greek, Omilite Elinika, do you speak Greek? To which I replied, Malsta, Omilo Elinika Kala, I speak Greek quite well. And he said, that's enough, that's enough, that's enough, I don't know anymore, that's all I know. And then he started talking about various people that he knew out in Turkey, including some of the Whittals, all of whom I'd known. And then how the result was that I joined the Swiss bank. I stayed with them on and off to the end of the peace era, in other words, 1939, when I joined the army again. And in that time, I was mostly in the foreign exchange department. But the last 7 or 8 years, I was given charge of what's known as the Credit Information Department. It's a department which inquires into credit worthiness, the reputation and standing of clients or of people who want to do business with you and who want credits and so on. And I stayed with the Swiss Bank till 1939. They had a very fine organization as a bank. After all, it is the biggest bank in Europe. Their clientele is worldwide, Switzerland is too small a country for a big bank of that size. So their clients were in Manchuria and China and India and Middle East, right out to North America, South America, and Australia and everywhere else. And I had this job with them. They had a very fine sports club. And I was always quite a bit of a sportsman. Naturally, I joined the club. And at one time, we ran 5 football teams. I was in the first team, and I captained the first team for a number of years. We entertained the Swiss teams that came over from Switzerland to play us over here, and we also went over to Switzerland to play against them over there for the Bank Cup. We also had quite a decent tennis section, and eventually I became captain of the tennis section. And we went over to Switzerland to play tennis against the Swiss offices. Came back with a cup. We also had other sections, such as cricket section, hockey sections, and so on. But this is just to describe the type of bank that I was in. The only trouble with the Swiss bank was the management. We had an exceedingly fine man as general manager, a Mr. Lorsignol. He was a Frenchman, a Protestant, and a socialist. All rather contradictory terms for a bank manager, a socialist, and a Frenchman as a Protestant. But he was an exceedingly fine man and a fire eater. But we got on like a house on fire. As being in charge of the credit information department, my work was practically solely with the management. And although I had to take a lot of ticking off from Mr. Lorsignol, I was always able to talk to him, and on several occasions I was able to stand up to him. And when he said yes, I was able to say no. And he was the type of man who would always say, why no? And I would explain, and he was such a big man that if I was right, he would always say, yes, Houghton, you're right. Thank you very much for drawing my attention to it. And if I was wrong, he would say, yes, Houghton, I see your point, but so-and-so has also happened, or the situation is such and such, that what you say, although normally would be right, under these present circumstances, it's not so. So please do as I say and don't argue too much. He was a very, very fine man, and I was very sorry to leave him when I had to join up the army. But even there, before I joined up, I had joined up in the emergency reserve at the time of Munich. And when the War Office asked me to go up to be interviewed, and I did so, I'll come back to that in a minute. I came back and told Mr. Lorsignol they want me to go out east on such and such a date, within a week's time. How do I stand? Because the staff manager, when I joined the emergency reserve, the staff manager would not commit himself. He said, all I can tell you is that the Swiss bank, being a foreign bank in London, would be at least as generous as any of the English banks. After all, we are here as the Swiss bank, and the Swiss bank realizes that it is here on sufferance. So to some extent, in the event of war, and you being called up, you receive quite generous treatment. So when I was called up and I went to Lord Signol and told him, asked him what they were going to do about it, he said, oh, we'll make up your salary to your army's pay to your civil salary. And we'll take all your army pay. So I naturally said, well, thank you very much, but my wife still has to carry on our home here in Lviv, and I still have to live as an officer on the same income as I've got now, keeping one home. In other words, I shall have to practically run two homes with the same income that I've got now, which I'm using for running one home. And we talked and argued about this. And he said, we are making sacrifice and paying you for really no services, and you must make a sacrifice also on your side. I said, thank you very much, but you're not making much sacrifice, as the difference between my army pay and my civilian pay is not all that big. And you'll be paying pence, when I'll be losing pounds. I said, for goodness sake, let me keep my allowances. So he said, allowances? Allowances, what are they? So I said, well, one allowance is £13 a month. That will be paid to my wife. Let her keep that. If I go on active service, I should get field allowance, possibly messing allowance or some other allowance, staff pay. You take my basic army pay as a lieutenant, which is what I would join up as, and let me keep all my allowances. To which he replied, that's very honest of you telling me about your allowances. Oh, I didn't know anything about them. Yes, yes, you keep your allowances. We just take your army pay for your rank. And that was settled, and I joined the army. But perhaps a little anecdote about joining the army may be interesting. The War Office had sent for me, as they wanted somebody with a knowledge of Greek and Turkish. And they had my name down, amongst a lot of others. I went up to the War Office, and lo and behold, there were 20, 30, or 40, I don't know how many of them, and had dozens of people like myself in civilian clothes waiting to be interviewed. And sure enough, every now and again, out would come somebody who'd just been interviewed, and he'd be surrounded by all these other chaps. What did he say? What did he want to? How much did he? Could you answer his questions easily? And how much did he tell you? And this, that, and the other. And I got to know exactly what questions were going to be asked. Well, the truth of the matter is that I had been up to be interviewed at the time of Munich, and I saw the same officer, a major, who, amongst other things, said to me at that time, that's Munich time, would you be prepared to go to Cambridge for a refresher course in Greece, in Greek? To which I had then said, I don't think it's necessary. My Greek is good. I don't have to have any refresher courses. As soon as I get into harness and I start working on Greek, I shan't need any refresher course at all. So this time, in February 1940, when I went up before him, I had already got an idea from the others who had come out as to what he was going to say to me. And I'd already prepared everything in my mind. So these chaps said, oh, he'll give you a bit of a newspaper to read in Greek, and then he wants a translation in English. He is then going to give you a letter in English written by a divisional general to a battalion commander, telling him that the divisional general, accompanied by his chief of staff, would be visiting the battalion front next day and he wanted to be met at a certain place by an officer who was capable of showing him round the front. So when I went in to see this chap, he said to me, "Oh, you are the man, you've been here before, you're the man who refused to go to Cambridge, aren't you, for a fresher course?" And I just got my back up, and I intended to bluff things out as hard as I could. So I said, "I never refused to go to Cambridge. I just said it wasn't necessary. I said, my Greek is good. I don't have to go to Cambridge for a fresher course." So he said, "Oh, we'll soon see. Read this bit of paper." So he gave me a bit of Greek newspaper, which I read, gave him the translation at once. Say, "Yes, excellent. Now, here's a letter in English. I want you to write it in Greek." Well, having been primed beforehand as to what the contents of this letter was, I read it, picked up a piece of paper and a pencil, and I threw back the English letter to the major. He said, "Here, you'll want this, you'll want this." He said, "I want a translation of it." I said, "I've read the letter. You want it in Greek. I'm not going to give you a word-for-word translation. I'm going to write that letter in Greek." And having already got it all pat in my mind, I just scribbled away as fast as I could.